It starts in Lake Ontario, meanders past dozens of islands, and snakes its way north towards the Atlantic Ocean. It crosses two modern national boundaries, nurturing communities with its waters and the ecosystems that it carries. This is Garigna-Goa, otherwise known as the St. Lawrence River. And this is its song, the inspiration for today's map. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Today's guest is an artist whose work draws on the beautiful and dramatic landscape of northeastern North America and its relationship to the indigenous communities who live there. Anna Kloss is an interdisciplinary visual artist of Ghanaian Kahaka, or Mohawk, and English descent. She studied at Ontario College of Art and Design and gained her Master of Fine Arts from Concordia University in 2004. Hannah's work draws on Indigenous methodology to explore themes of place, language, and identity. Her work has been exhibited internationally in the US, Portugal, Switzerland, and now here in London at Canada House Gallery, where I'm speaking to her today. Hannah, welcome to What's Your Map? And the first question I'm going to ask you is, what is your map, which is actually something that we're standing in front of? And I wonder if you can just tell me what it is, please.
The map is the installation that is titled Water Song. And it's a sound wave suspended on thread using digital imagery printed on transparent discs.
Tell us about the river that it represents, Hannah.
So the river is the one that surrounds Jaja'ake, Montreal. Montreal is an island, and it's the St. Lawrence River, Gagnat Darawana. And it is one that, you know, I guess Jacques Cartier came up oh so long ago to set foot in our lands, and is still there today as a major route for shipping as well to get through. It goes from the Atlantic Ocean to Lake Ontario.
Mm. And what is its symbolism as a river for the Haudenosaunee? Because it has a very specific importance, I guess, for the lands of your people.
Well, Gagnat Darawana really just means big river. Rivers in general were the way they were the highways of old. It's how we got around. You know, you sort of have runners on the land, portage into the canoes to travel between communities. So it has that same importance now. I think originally a lot of the original highways sort of followed rivers, you know, just because that was the routes that people knew until they built new things that just sort of cut straight through in straight lines as opposed to winding through the valleys and things.
So it does collide with that European sense of map making. We think of a map, it's a two-dimensional graphic representation of space. And often in terms of the First Nations that we're talking about, that's about expropriating that land, claiming that land, and the map is important for that. And I look at this, your piece here, and my sense is that this is mapping a different tradition. It's trying to, maybe reclaim is too strong a term, but it's trying to say there are different ways of mapping those spaces, and this is you trying to say this is a way in which First Nations people would have understood that space and shared that space.
This is the way that I understand the space and want to share that understanding of the space. I think that it's more about relationship than the idea of owning or claiming in that sense. So it's expressing a relationship with the land, with the bodies, with the bodies of water. I think the way that I've created this, that I've made this, is they hang on threads, and the threads are meant to be seen. It's not meant to kind of try and suspend something invisibly into the air. The threads are meant to be seen. They're chosen specifically because they reflect the light, and they're meant to touch the ground. So because it goes from, I'll say, earth to sky, if you're you know, going outside of the gallery walls or sort of floor to ceiling, but it's to reference that relationship of earth to sky, which is an important one for us, as well as rivers that sort of go west to east in that sense. So it's talking about connection in the different possible directions, and brings, I would say, cosmology into it because of that as well.
And how did you make it? Can you just explain to me the process? Because it's also connected to songs connected to the river, isn't it? And the way in which you've done this, I think, is fascinating. Can you just explain what the process is, and using also digital technology to create this installation piece?
Yeah, it's very much a song. It's a song that is, it's the sound wave of a song that was sung to thank and honor the river. The song was composed by Yunya Rorox Macumber, who's someone that actually was a student of mine at one point and lives in Ganawage. Ganawage is the Ganyikahaga community that is on the south shore, across from Montreal. I guess I should say Montreal is Ganyikahaga territory. Ganyikahaga is the name that most people would know as Mohawk, but Ganyikahaga is what we call ourselves. It means the people of the Flint. And I think because it's hard for people to learn the indigenous words, but when you know that they actually have this meaning, I feel like it just sort of brings so much more sense to it. So people of the Flint, if you think of a flint, that's what creates a spark. It's what makes the fire. So if you're the people that have the stone that makes the fire, you've then got food, you've got warmth, you have a lot of power just because you've got the flint. So I kind of like to tell that story and make it a little bit more worthwhile to try and learn how to say the word.
But it's also then connected to water, isn't it? So your work is often, for me, it seems to me, very much about mapping, because it's about rocks, it's about water, it's about rivers, it's about these, as it were, we might, you know, in English talk about them as cartographic connections, but you're representing them in different ways and drawing on those different First Nations cosmologies, aren't you, to try and tell a kind of slightly different story, I think. So the whole cosmology, I think, of the Haudenosaunee is very much about mapping in a way, because it's still a cosmology. I think the other pieces that you've represented are very much, it seems to me, maps as well, although they're very artistic and about process. There is something very, it's a process of mapping. Maybe that's an important distinction. Mapping is, I guess, a different process to like creating the Western map. And it seems to me that also the process of creating these extraordinary installation pieces, it is a form of labor of mapping certain pieces, is it not?
Well, I think it's expressing this relationship to the land, and a relationship with the river that's been expressed through the original sound, through song, and now visually. On the actual discs are printed images of that shore, of the place, and then the layout follows the shoreline, so it's sort of undulating through the gallery in the layout, the way that the river would wind through the land. I think if thinking of mapping as a way to as a way to locate yourself within a territory and how to understand where to go. I do like to think of it that way in a very kind of esoteric way, I guess, in that sense. I think that, or I know that Indigenous peoples in North America did not stay in one place. I mean, they were traveling for forever. They traveled across the continent. People were trained from the day they were born to learn how to be able to make those journeys that would last months. And this was to then trade. And the importance of the trading was not just to get the good tobacco or the good canoes, so that was part of it. It was to talk about relationship. It was relationship with the different people. So that's how we got corn from, you know, South America. The tobacco that grows in my territory does not grow out west. These different things all circulated and were in movement. And the maps, they did this by the stars, by the rivers. And I think that's something where they were much more in a relationship with the land in that way to be able to do that.
Just explain some of the materials and the process of actually putting it together and what we're looking at.
The material is, I call it, it's a transparent film that is like an acetate. I don't know if chemically the composition is exactly the same as an acetate, but it's sort of thick enough to be stiff and not floppy. And these discs have digital images printed onto them of the place where the song was sung and that the song was written for. The place is called Flat Rocks, and it's a stony, flat part of the shore that people from Kahnawake would go to have picnics and just kind of informal gathering space with families and that sort of thing, that ended up actually being cut off when the government decided to build the St. Lawrence Seaway. They expropriated the land, moved the homes, and cut into the land to create a seaway for container transport shipping needs, basically.
When was that?
I think 1970s.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can still access this place, but it's a lot harder to get to. You have to kind of go around quite a bit to get to it. So that's the images are sort of water, stone, trees, sky, this sort of thing.
And it snakes around the room, and we're very close to it. I'm just inches from it. And because of that, and as we talk, it is moving slightly. The threads are just slowly blowing slightly. And as we look through it, because it curves around and through the room, you know, if you sort of squint, you do capture that sense of being on a river, that sense of the light moving, the play on the water. It is very, very beguiling in that way, because it does capture that. So there's something very specific about it. And I wonder, is this part of what the works are doing? It's very specific to a certain cosmology and a certain river, but there's also universalism to this, is there not? As I look at it, there's something I can both locate it from what you tell me, but it also has certain evocations of something much more universal for me.
What I see as my role as an artist is to be able to create something that is enough to solicit the interest of the people who are out and about to come and sort of engage with the work. So it sort of draws on some universals. And then if you want to sort of get down into it and into the layers, it gets more specific, but starts with a universal to draw people in.
Before we delve further into Hannah's experiences as a First Nations artist, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From exploring cave etchings to charting constellations, we have 4 seasons of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series or the next. Now, let's hear more from Hannah. We've very much come to you with the idea of what's your map, but I wonder in your longer artistic practice how you've thought about mapping and how it's influenced what you make.
I think in terms of mapping, I was interested in that connection with the podcast and to think about my art in that way, because I have looked at maps in the past that are, you know, this idea of something that's somebody that's decided this is how the world looks, and that because it's written down on paper, it's taken as being what is true and just. And I think we all know about that idea of the world map. If you actually drew how large Africa truly is, it has nothing to do with how it's represented on the globe that we all had in our schools, at least when I was little. Maybe it's changed now, but the real representation is very different. So it's that whole idea of map and history as being tailored to a particular people and a particular worldview. So I think in my work, it's letting room for these other worldviews to come forward. I try and express it through a Ganyakehago worldview, and then sometimes sort of a more general, larger indigenous worldview. I think it's really important to know that indigenous folks were traveling across North America long before the colonizers came, and were engaging in trade long before the colonizers came. It's just that trade was not transaction, it was ceremony. And in saying trade is ceremony, it means it's about relationship. So I think if there's something that I hope sort of comes through in my work and that people can come away with, is that idea of relationship with the world around us, and I'll even say with the world's plural around us, a different way of sort of looking at the world that surrounds you is kind of my goal.
I was thinking when I was looking at your work that one thing I do when I teach literature and mapping, the first thing I do is give the students a blank piece of paper and I say, draw the world. And of course, they all draw what we would call a map. And that's the first thing I say, why did you all draw a map? And it strikes me with your work that you wouldn't necessarily look at this and say, it's a map. But in effect, what you are doing is a form of mapping. And I remember the students' faces, they all go, oh, yeah, why are we drawing a map? But it is so hardwired, particularly in Western culture. But I think what your work shows is that, you know, that need not be the case.
I'm going to say one of the things that I get my students to do is to draw a basket and see what they come up with.
And what happens?
As a basket. I've had different, I'm working with more sort of artist types, so I've had some pleasing results, but it's in relation to sort of text talking about basket, bead, and quill, the idea of decoration and materials. But baskets, I've had people sort of take the paper, cut it into strips, and start to weave a basket. Mm. I had some others, because it's also a group activity. It's never a singular activity, so that also creates a different dynamic.
Can we talk about aesthetics and, I guess, really the role of beauty and the creation of the objects and the artworks, which are very beautiful? This is very much about beauty, is it not? And that seems to be important for you.
I think in my work, it's something that I use to draw people in a little bit. It's sort of a strategy. But it's also, it's a way of honoring and respecting the ideas that I'm working with, basically. I think traditional, quote unquote, indigenous practices such as beadwork and different kinds of painting and this sort of thing, the craftsmanship, I think it's something that in Western art historical sort of thought is something that was sort of dismissed at a certain point as being superficial, sort of maybe staying at the surface. And to me, it's sort of a foundational part of what I do to express the relationship with the ideas that I'm showing. So it comes in through the use of image, light, reflection, these sorts of things.
it's simply a way to maybe honor the elements that I'm trying to work with.
And presumably the fragility of those elements, because it seems, as we've been talking, that there's an ecology to the work as well, because you talk about the audience needs to really have a certain sort of respect and to take care of the artwork, and the artwork itself is quite fragile just in its actual materiality. So there seems to be a sense of ecology being important within the work as well.
I think that's really with installation. Installation is a kind of artwork that is made to become a part of a space. So I think of it as, you know, painting, photography, the sort of two-dimensional works we understand, they go on the wall. Sculpture as being something that is three-dimensional but might, you know, sit on a plinth, you can walk around. Installation is, it doesn't really exist until it's installed. And with my installations, I do work with a sense of fragility that for me is to kind of solicit something from the viewer. So if they're going to experience it, they need to sort of be aware and take care in order for the artwork to exist. In this instance, it would be not sort of saying, I'm going to walk through that installation and, you know, try and become a part of it, because you would then find yourself in a mass of threads and disrupting things. Mm. It's one of the ways that I sort of hope to start to create an interest for someone to come in and look and stay a little longer, to then not just think, oh, this is interesting, but I wonder what the artist is trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Hannah, can you tell me about DAFNI, the arts organization that you're involved with?
Yes, my exhibition is a part of DAFNI. DAFNI is the artist-run center that I and three of my friends, colleagues, started about 5 years ago now. And Laurie Beavis, who's the curator for the exhibition, is an independent curator, as well as the executive director of DAFNI. So it's an Indigenous artist-run center that is in Jogjaghe, that's in Montreal. And we started up because we wanted a place for Indigenous artists and Indigenous arts. I think that it's the first one that is an Indigenous-led arts, not-for-profit art space in Quebec, and there's a few others throughout Canada. We show contemporary Indigenous art. It's funded through different arts councils, and have also programming happening that's sort of workshops and artist talks. We did a thing at the Kahnawake Powwow where we had a powwow pop-up. We brought contemporary art to the powwow in the tent, put up art and told everybody about DAFNI. It was a lot of fun. There's a lot going on. It's good, but it's a very good. We're very happy with all of the stuff that DAFNI is able to do.
Where does your work take you next?
I'm working on an exhibition that's coming up in Montreal, actually, a solo exhibition, and I'm creating the installation downstairs is the Water Song for the South Shore, and I'm working on the installation for the North Shore. And I think ultimately, in part, it's because the South Shore is here in London, so I'm making the North Shore to be then show in Jogjaghe. But ultimately, in 2027, I'll have an exhibition at the Musée des Beaux-Arts de Montréal, and I hope to show both shores together. And I just think it would be fabulous, because then the viewers will be able to walk through and sort of be surrounded by the river, which is sort of the ultimate goal. But you need to have a big space that can take it.
I'm curious to ask about East and West on that basis, having written a book about the four points. I mean, is there a symbolism there? About how does the symbolism work around North and South and East and West within that cosmology? Is there very specific ideas? Because, you know, in the West, you talk about the North at the top and the South down. Is there a similar sort of orientation within the First Nations cosmologies, or how does that work?
I think it's just all around. In terms of direction, you really situate yourself by being in the land and by what is around you. I've done some work with, it's a project started by a colleague and friend at another university who's also Gnanik Haga. And she started something called the Mohawk Atlas. You can find it online. It's the mohawkatlas.org, Gnanik Haga Atlas. And this is an atlas for Indigenous folks, and specifically Gnanik Haga. And it's really mapping that territory, Gnanik Haga territory, so sort of along the St. Lawrence River from sort of Lake Ontario to the Atlantic Ocean. And you can go on there and see they do different workshops in different communities and go out on the land with elders and reclaim the names in Gnanikeha of the different places. And the atlas is interesting because they're actual little, they have the ability to support media so that you get sort of recordings or videos of elders telling stories that connect two different things in the land. And one of the things, they also use sort of old maps that they will try and see, well, what is that word actually? Because names are always copied down wrong or half right. And one of the things that they found was in the river, sort of halfway between Toronto and Montreal, sort of around Kingston, there's a really large sort of rock type small island in the river. And it was called something that was connected to the word star or constellation, which is Yajistogorunyo. And they were like, why would that be called star or constellation? And they ended up figuring out that it was because that rock was the guiding point to then know which way to go in different places. And so they called it star constellation because that's what we use the stars for. So because it was the guiding point, that's the name that it had, you know. So at first, like, does it look like a star? Is it somehow connect? But no, it was because of its function.
So, amazing. That's great.
Yeah.
So you've sent us off to the Mohawk Atlas, which is just amazing. Hannah, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch at Whistledown Studios. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland Collection of Antique Maps and Atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland Collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.